Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you, the Bishara Trust. Thank you, everyone, for coming out this afternoon. Can you hear me?
Yes.
At the back, all right? I thought I was going to be amplified. Can you hear me? Okay, I'll try and project. As Elizabeth said, when I was first asked to give this talk, I came up with the theme, which I'd been thinking about for some time. Once I started wondering what I was going to write about, I thought, this is very overreaching. So I should start by stating that I have no credentials whatsoever to speak on these subjects as a philosopher or a theologian or a historian, and I am not, in any conventional sense of the term, a believer. I'm not a member of a religion nor a strict follower of a prophetic tradition. I am interested in how these terms, atheism, agnosticism, belief, shift meaning depending on the context in which they're used, and especially in what the experience is of looking at the world and ourselves through each of these lenses. The interest is purely personal. For the past 10 years or so, I have joined a group of friends for weekly silent meditation. And it was probably at least 5 years in before any of us asked each other how it was we'd come to meditation. After I had described a little of my experience at the Bishara school, one of my friends said to me, "I wish I were a believer." I was quite taken aback, as I would not have defined myself that way. Not long after, I read the best-selling books on atheism by Richard Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens with a different group of friends, two of whom are here today, I'm so pleased to see, and found I was one of few in the room who did not clearly identify as an atheist. For the record, I don't think of myself as an agnostic either. So where does that leave me? Apparently, with an increasing number of the population of both Great Britain and the United States who identify as unaffiliated, the fastest growing category in both the 2011 British census and a recent US Pew Research poll on religion, which includes the religious and secular unaffiliated. I personally would in no way equate unaffiliated with uncommitted, and would state my religious path, if there were such a category, as wanting to see things how they really are, regardless of how they might be described by another. And I might also say, if there were enough room on the form, that although atheism, agnosticism, and belief appear to be in contradiction with each other, at times each one takes on a lens which seems appropriate through which to look at the world. We are all of us in the 21st century profoundly impacted by modern science and what might be called its artistic response, modernism. The project of modernism, so often derided for bringing about moral relativity in a godless world, has been hugely helpful at sweeping away illusion and breaking through perceptual barriers. The arts at their best do such a good job of conveying meaning without being definitive. So I wanted to explore this subject with the help of a few favourite paintings and a little through the lens of science. Welcome. Some of you may have been privileged to have seen the exhibition Ice Age Art at the British Museum last year. This was described as the arrival of the modern mind, and showcased a number of exquisite sculptures, mostly found in Northern Europe from as far back as 40,000 years. We know nothing at all about the beliefs, rituals, social orders, gods, goddesses, spirits of the people who made these. But what was so moving in gazing at them was how obviously they communicated a sense of transcendence. The curators made clear that each of the pieces would have taken months to make, given the tools available, and that therefore, for a hunter-gatherer society, they must have held huge significance. But the pieces themselves, without this information, conveyed powerfully their purpose to connect with a higher order, the way all sacred art does, or I should say all good art. And at least while I was there, there was a palpable sense, a kind of reverence on the part of the attendees to be in the presence of these far, far distant humans' relative search. Interestingly, the curators chose to show these works alongside art by Henry Moore, Mondrian, Matisse, and others. This is Henry Moore on the right. Artists of the modern movement, which movement consciously broke with the tradition of explaining the context of images? So the two periods of art were in easy dialogue with each other. One had no known spiritual context and the other deliberately avoided it. And to quote the catalogue, each showed the fundamental human desire to communicate and make art as a way of understanding ourselves and the world. This is Matisse. Over the past 40,000 years, of course, we have evidence of human belief in innumerable forms, statues, paintings, writings, buildings from throughout the world. We know more or less about the details of these beliefs, but the objects themselves convey a transcendent and compelling meaning. Why else do we unearth, collect, display, and admire them so? For more than 1,000 years, of course, European art, literature, music, architecture has been deeply entwined with the story of Christianity. In its various forms, and notwithstanding the major convulsions which have taken place within it, it remained for over a millennium the imaginative presence within which the vast majority of Europeans lived. Most of them, up until the 19th century, would have been baptized, married, and buried within one or other Christian church. The Old and New Testaments provided the images and stories, the sense of beginning and end, the moral framework, which were all shared. It's worth remembering this when we look back on the great crisis of faith, which began to shatter the Christian narrative with the dramatic discoveries of the 19th century. In the late 18th century, the Scottish geologist James Hutton, after careful observation of the sedimentary layers of earth on his Berwickshire farm, began to overturn the prevailing theories of the Neptunists, who had been seeking to find evidence in geology for Noah's flood. Hutton described a universe very different from the biblical cosmos, one formed by a continuous cycle in which rocks and soil are washed into the sea, compacted into bedrock, forced up to the surface by volcanic processes, and eventually worn away into sediment again. The result, therefore, of this physical inquiry, Hutton concluded, is that we find no vestige of a beginning and no prospect of an end. Hutton was accused of being atheist, of contradicting biblical truth. Hutton's theories strongly influenced Darwin, who, after close study of the Galapagos finches' beaks, among other things, developed his theory of evolution, and we all know how unsettling that was. These, with other discoveries of the period, were, of course, not the first to have upended prevailing beliefs, Galileo providing a prime example. But the data-driven discoveries of the 19th century began in Europe and America as seismic undermining of the creation story, and something began to unravel. The physical world would no longer be investigated for evidence of religious truth. The reverse. Belief was to be put aside to allow for an unimpeded observation. The approach the scientists would adopt while observing data would be atheist, whatever their private belief, if they had one. Scientific objectivity requiring the view from nowhere, as the philosopher Thomas Nagel has called it, however unattainable, has been the accepted approach ever since. We attempt to allow the world to tell us what it is, rather than look to it for proof of pre-existing beliefs. We can try to imagine what it would have been like at the time to absorb these bombshells. Our own grandparents and great-grandparents had to confront what this meant for their own belief. The majority of Christians and Jews now in Europe and even in America, in spite of the flourishing Creation Museum in Kentucky, which disproves Darwin, do not find the theory of evolution makes biblical truth meaningless. It does not shatter their faith, and they found a variety of ways to live with both versions of the truth. But in 1851, coincidentally, the same year that Darwin stopped going to church, Matthew Arnold expressed the shattering loss of faith in his mournful elegy on Dover Beach, which ends with the lines, "Ah, love, let us be true to one another, for the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night." I first came across this poem as a teenager and loved it. I was not a brooding melancholic, and I did not at all believe that the world no longer held joy. But in the way that poetry can get its hooks into you and carry meanings beyond words, I took to this one and have come back to it over the years, giving it another go. And now I deeply appreciate his evocation of the facing of the loss of everything felt dear, everything he thought he knew. And of course that, "Ah, love, let us be true to one another," makes all the difference. Because if love and truth remain, we actually can let go of the rest. This loss of faith was the preamble to modernism. The developments in art, architecture, literature, music, dance, theatre, which rejected the certainties of Enlightenment thinking and religious belief, and which the world found so shocking. We can trace this briefly, and not at all comprehensively, by looking at this evolving in a few pieces of art from the last 120 years or so. Starting with the Impressionists, who embarked on this process of learning to see without the visual image referring to something, but simply allowing it to awaken the perception of light and colour. These were radicals in their time, violating the rules of academic painting, painting outdoors, looking to capture momentary and transitory effects of light. These paintings here are from the first Paris exhibition of 1874, which caused such an uproar. What is so interesting is how easy it is to love these now. So much so they're sometimes snobbishly dismissed, and we have to struggle to recapture the drama of that first startling view. Monet Pizarro here, there's a wonderful quote, somebody going, "What is this? What are we looking at here?" And they're going, "Well, it's hoarfrost on a ploughed furrows." "Furrows? They don't look like furrows. It's just palette scrapings." "Well, perhaps, but it's the impression is there." "Well, funny kind of impression," is where they got their name from. So not appreciated at all at the time. And this from Cézanne. "An over-exclusive love of yellow has compromised his future." In the same way that the theory of evolution does not rattle most of us now, these paintings have just happily settled into our lives. A few years later, Van Gogh, now apparently the most popular painter in the world, struggled alone to find, as he said in a letter to his brother Theo, the high yellow. A search which at the time only Theo and Gauguin might have understood, but which we can recognize so easily now as a transcendent quest. Now that yellow is so ubiquitous, we have to struggle to see past the endless reproductions to embrace the height he was searching for. By the time we reach Mondrian, we are moving into abstraction. This from 1909, 1913, and 1936. The First World War has happened. The general theory of relativity has been published. All representational forms are abandoned. This is Mondrian talking. "Today one is tired of the dogmas of the past and of truths once accepted but successfully jettisoned. One realizes more and more the relativity of everything, and therefore one tends to reject the idea of fixed laws, of a single truth. The important task of all art is to destroy the static equilibrium by establishing a dynamic one. Non-figurative art demands the destruction of a particular form and the construction of a rhythm of mutual relations." These artists are on fire, on a mission to open eyes to light and colour and line, unencumbered by the forms to which they are habitually attached. They are not using art to tell a story or establish a belief, but using it to ask questions and provoke insight. Of course, all great art does this and has always done so, but in modernism, it's done overtly. This is Alexander Calder from 1948 saying Just as one can compose colours and forms, so one can compose motions. This is one of his mobiles. Jean-Paul Sartre wrote, "Although Calder has not sought to imitate anything, his one aim is to create chords and cadences of unknown movements. His mobiles are the tangible symbol of nature. That nature of which we shall never know whether it is the blind sequence of causes and effects, or the timid, endlessly deferred, rumpled and ruffled unfolding of an idea," capital I. I think this is a masterful explanation of the ability of art to convey two different possibilities in a single piece. What Elizabeth was referring to, the kind of work that Ibn Arabi does. You can literally show them both in one object. Little private celebrations, Sartre called these. Is the world around us a random sequence of events, or is it covering up a grand idea? Just as a footnote, I came across this quote at an exhibition of Calder's works in Los Angeles last month. And an elderly man standing next to me was sort of rubbing his head and going, "Do you understand what he's talking about here?" Yeah. And I said, "Well, I think it might mean that." And he said, "Well, do you think..." And we talked for about 15 minutes on this subject. And there's not many places in everyday life where you can have that kind of conversation with complete strangers. But art does that. These images are chosen specifically because they're artists whose work I've seen in the last year. It could have been any number of them. And I find myself with, it seems, an increasing number of others visiting museums for sheer pleasure, engagement, enlightenment. According to a recent article in The Economist headlined "Temples of Delight," museum building and museum attendance has increased rapidly over the past 30 years. In 2012, American museums received 850 million visits, more than all the big league sporting events and theme parks combined. Half the adult population of England visited a museum last year. China is building literally thousands of new museums. Several serious new museums have gone up in the Gulf states. 20th century modern art is attracting an increasing following. 5 million visited the Tate Modern last year. And MoMA in New York is one of the most visited American museums. The article suggests people are looking to museums for guidance, but not for answers. And that museum directors are increasingly aware that they need to engage the visitors rather than to lecture them. The Los Angeles County Museum this year mounted one of three major exhibitions of recent work by James Turrell, an artist who has spent most of his life working directly with light alone, trying to eliminate even the forms that light falls on so that we can see ourselves seeing. If the light falls on an object, he says, we see the object, and our previous perception prevents us seeing things as they really are. He wants to try and eliminate prejudiced seeing. This one from the Guggenheim. This one is called Bridget's Bardot. His grandest project harks right back to our earliest ancestors, creating a naked eye observatory at Rodin Crater in the Arizona desert. Not this time to provide answers to our place in the universe, but to allow a profound and personal engagement with the sky, sun, moon, and stars from a private position. This is an extraordinary project that he's been working on for 20, 30 years now. He's carved out the center of this crater and created these separate rooms that you can look at particular sunrises, sunsets, moon, and just look at a particular patch of sky for a period of time. Sadly, not open to public yet. It would be too glib to call the modern scientific approach atheistic or modernist art agnostic. Scientists and artists themselves have much that's interesting and various to say on this subject, but both do require a putting aside of belief to increase perception and knowledge. We have been educated by these modernists, whether we're aware of it or not, and we do owe a huge debt to them. Time and exposure has not only made it easy to love Impressionism, but also to be comfortable with not knowing what later and more inscrutable works of art mean. We've been encouraged to open our eyes and let the light in, and not require an answer. And this extends throughout the arts. Musicians threw out melody and fixed rhythms so we could hear sounds in a different way. Architects broke with traditional orders so we could re-experience space and light. Dancers looked for movement from an internal core and not an external order. Writers loosened narrative and plot so they could examine the unresolved and the absurd and the sheer complexity of words. On or about December 1910, human character changed, Virginia Woolf stated hyperbolically. Relations between masters and servants, husbands and wives, parents and children shifted, she said. And when human relations change, there is at the same time a change in religion, conduct, politics, and literature. I don't know what happened specifically to Virginia Woolf in December 1910, but she was clearly on to something. Because along with dramatic scientific advances and radical artistic upheavals, there has clearly been, in the West at least, major changes in human relations since then. If the 20th century witnessed genocide on a scale never seen before, it also, in counterpoint, produced the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and an ever-expanding understanding of what this might mean. And if religion or belief needed to be put aside for scientific inquiry and artistic breakthroughs, it has often had to be circumvented in issues concerning morality and social justice. The civil rights movement, of course, was strongly rooted in the black church, though it's also true that the Bible had given plenty of textual cover condoning slavery and apartheid. Liberation theology, which mined Catholic teaching to understand the roots of poverty and shift the consciousness of the poor, was also roundly silenced by the Catholic Church. The women's movement, the gay rights movements, have had to work very hard to overcome, where they have done so, religious doctrine. And it's interesting to note that in recent surveys, political surveys in America, it indicates quite clearly that the rapid increase in acceptance of gay relationships within even quite conservative religious communities has come about, when it has, through personal contact. So love of humanity over and over again can transcend religious doctrine. And knowledge of what is precedes what belief in what should be. These days, there is no shortage of critique of religion. Atheism and agnosticism, quietly a part of the critical dialogue for the past 150 years or so, have burst out of the closet. In the last 20 years, with a stream of books, articles, debates between atheists and believers, lectures on the incompatibility of science with religion. What is new, Adam Gopnik in The New Yorker wrote just this week, is, quote, a tone frankly contemptuous of religion. The aforementioned books by Dawkins and Hitchens, which I personally found irritating, simultaneously barking up the wrong tree and flogging a dead horse. They each trotted out well-known examples of the evil done in the name of religion and the incomprehensibility of religious tales and supernatural doings. And they both managed to dismiss 40,000 years of human engagement with transcendence by almost all of our human relatives as delusional. Boiled down, though, the principal point of both these best-selling atheists would seem to be that the God of religion is created in the imagination of the believer, which then becomes their authority figure. This subjects the believer to dogmatism and strips them of responsibility for their actions. Ibn Arabi, whose magnificent book of poems, The Tarjuman of Ashwak, produced the title of this talk, would entirely agree. Ibn Arabi, living in the Middle Ages, when the sun and the fixed stars apparently moved around the earth, the devout Muslim, devoted follower of the Prophet Muhammad, steeped in the revealed text of the Quran, said, agreeing with these pompous atheists, God conforms himself to the belief of his servant. Whoever believes that God is such and such, he appears to him in the form of his belief, from the Futuhat. Take care not to be tied by any particular belief while denying all others, for much good would escape you. In fact, knowledge of how things are would evade you. Truth reveals itself in the imagination, says Ibn Arabi. This is the realm where forms take on meaning and meanings descend into forms. Many scientists and artists would, I think, agree with this. But if the access to the imagination is filtered through pre-existing belief, or if it is coloured by projections or fantasies or hopes or fears or history, truth cannot appear as it is. It's precisely because we create God or truth in our belief that Ibn Arabi demands an emptying of belief, a removal of conditioning, so that we can see the truth as it is, not how we think it should be. The responsibility of the believer is in keeping the heart pure, in not attaching to belief. And so long as we are unable to do this, we will be serving a God of our own projection, and therefore under an authority which is not real. And this applies to everyone, whatever their belief, or their lack of belief, or their uncertainty. However they think the world is, it appears to them that way, and they have difficulty seeing it another way. The universe is annihilated and recreated at every moment, claims Ibn Arabi, breathing in, breathing out. Meaning appears and then is erased, and then appears again in another form. This finds resonance in the profession of faith of the Muslim. There is no God but God. There is no God but God. The Tajamanalashwak, the interpreter of desires, is a series of poems written in the classical Arabic tradition, extolling the beauty of the beloved in the meeting around the campfire in the desert, and then lamenting her departure in the morning as the camel trains depart, leaving nothing but traces in the sand. The beauty only remains in the heart. This is not a million miles away from Matthew Arnold's lament on Dover Beach. In spite of all he says is lost, his love remains, and truth is still the object. So what then is the belief of a heart capable of every form? If we leave aside the origin stories, the promises of life after death, the miracles of the chosen ones, the prescriptions for right behavior, and the punishments for wrong, there seems to be an essential element to all belief, which is that the quest for truth, beauty, goodness, however it's described, the quest is reciprocated. Something out there responds to something in us. To assert that this is not the case seems to me as nonsensical as saying that no good would come of contemplating a late self-portrait by Rembrandt, or reading War and Peace, or listening to Miles Davis, or whatever it is that brings you to a sense of connection. The proof for this, of course, lies in the personal experience, which is to say there is no proof. The sense of sublime, whether through religion or art or music, is so transitory, sometimes communicable, but never definable. So there's no agreement about where it can be found, except sometimes when we recognize that someone has witnessed what we have witnessed. Religion at its best clearly serves to develop this sense of the experience of the sublime and to share the witnessing, to position the believer in the best state to receive an authentic vision of what is real and what is right, and provide a place, the community, in which to share this. But everyone, atheist, agnostic, and believer, has to develop their own ability to receive, has to find a method of recognizing truth, of following their own conscience. Even Pope Francis agrees that the question for us all is to follow our conscience. The point of looking at science and the arts is that they are all the result of human beings' struggle to produce authentic visions of reality. And the process of learning to recognize an authentic vision seems to be the same in religion, science, art, and human affairs. The need to distinguish between the authentic and a vision which is a fantasy or a pretension or a projection or a desire, or an assumed knowledge, or a connection with history or culture which has got stuck. The process of learning to appreciate art usually begins with studying with someone who knows something about it, looking at paintings in books, studying some more, visiting museums, unlearning what you thought you knew, looking again, till you begin to develop something of an eye of your own. It requires some concentration and application and desire to be educated and some rigor to remove preconceived ideas. As the aforementioned Miles Davis said, it takes a long time to learn to play like yourself. When the taste is well developed, the eye can tell instantly what has value, just as those who had the eye saw what the Impressionists were up to at their first show. The rest of us may have to wait until the general education of the zeitgeist seeps into us. If we admire science, we'd like to think that as soon as a scientific truth is demonstrated, we are able to accept it, whatever concepts it contradicts. If we love art, we'd like to think that as soon as a new vision presents itself, we recognize it. If we're inspired by social justice movements, we like to think we would instantly leap to the side of the righteous. The possibility that Ibn Arabi, amongst others, presents is a vision like this about everything at every moment. To be so empty of self that the truth appears in a new configuration at every moment without attachment to past forms. Scientists, artists, poets, prophets, mystics all help with this. We live in extraordinary times. Moral relativism on one side, the return to extreme religious fundamentalism on the other. But we also have available unprecedented access to the spiritual heritage of humanity. In the last 50 years or so, previously esoteric texts in Sanskrit, Tibetan, Hebrew, Arabic, Aramaic, Greek have emerged and been translated, along with respectful, close studies of indigenous communities, all offering multiple prisms through which to look at transcendence and the human search for it. These all help to rub off the encrusted edges of a single belief system. Scientific inquiry and the close observation of data clears up our woolly interpretations of phenomena. And artists in all fields have embarked to provoke our senses to take in the light with unprejudiced vision. This is not to suggest that studies in comparative religion or frequent visitors to blockbuster art shows will bring us to the vision of an Ibn Arabi. Professor William Chittick, in a lecture in Berkeley last year, reprinted in the Journal of the Ibn Arabi Society this month, spoke on this point. He emphasized that this much loved and quoted poem of our title, "My Heart Has Become Capable of Every Form," is written from the vision of one who achieved union with the real, achieved only by following most rigorously the prescriptions of religion. Paradoxically, the most broad, liberating, and universal vision, where the truth appears as it is, without screening, comes about for him through intense application, discipline, study, and submission. "It is not easy to become a perfect man," Ibn Arabi states most charmingly in The Kernel of the Kernel. Yet he does state that this is the true potential of the human being. This is another piece by James Turrell. The vision his poem evokes is so attractive, so compelling, that it leads us on. Whatever path we take, with or without a formal religion, it requires us to access our inner atheism when it's time to abandon meanings, our inner agnosticism when we need to know that we don't know, and our inner believer when it's the moment to step back and receive, to be moved by compassion or swept away by beauty. "My heart has become capable of every form. It is a pasture for gazelles and a convent for Christian monks, and a temple for idols and the pilgrim's Kaaba, and the tables of the Torah and the book of the Quran. I follow the religion of love. Whatever way love's camels take, that is my religion and my faith." Thank you.